So now we know all about the violent, unstable, possibly mentally ill, inflammatory, dangerous fellow Omar Mateen. His ex-wife makes this charge, as well as former co-workers who also recalled him talking of killing people. Still, none of this caused him to fail background checks or screenings at the security company he worked for. In two separate interviews by FBI agents, he was questioned and released. Robert Shugg is an assistant professor of criminal justice and forensic psychology at California State University, Long Beach. He's author of the book Mental Illness and Crime. Do we even use the words mental illness in what we know so far about this fellow, Omar Mateen?
Well, hello, John. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I think that that's a really great point. The telltale signs of mental illness haven't at least shown up yet, I believe, in this evolving media coverage. And this story is changing by the hour, right? Literally from last night until this morning. And there's a couple new bits of information. So, but I don't see, other than perhaps a bit of paranoia and maybe gender identity issues, the telltale signs that we would associate with violence.
Well, before we get to the gender identity issues, go back for a moment to the Santa Barbara case, the shooting there where the individual had a angry manifesto that he published at the time of the shooting about how he had difficulty with women, that it turned him to actually hate them, and he hated anyone who had any sort of happy, normal sexual relationship. This anger, motivated by something that we find familiar, to produce an act that we find unfamiliar and completely out of bounds. Is there any way to track something like that?
Well, that's a really good point. I think with the Santa Barbara shooter, he was really, from a psychological point of view, compensating for like a very low self-esteem. He came across as very narcissistic, but probably found or thought about himself as being very small. And so the anger then becomes kind of a tool. And certainly the signs might show up along the way, and the loved ones and friends might see things that perhaps seem uncharacteristic, but then perhaps just sort of get swept under the rug. And then in the meantime, for the individual, the rage is building, and you know, like a snowball, and fueling itself, and eventually it comes out.
So conceivably, there's a parallel development with the sexual identity questions that have been raised in media reports about Omar Mateen and the building anger, the low self-esteem, the kind of narcissistic tendencies that we saw in Santa Barbara being repeated here in a slightly different narrative.
I think there could be. I think you're making a great you're drawing a great parallel between this sort of inner conflict, where in Santa Barbara the conflict was between, you know, I feel worthless, I feel like nothing, so I have to build myself up. Where in the Orlando case, maybe it's a fellow who is questioning his own gender identity and feeling very conflicted about it, and that's superimposed on this very sort of rigid faith-based system that it's incompatible, and so he's dealing with this inner conflict.
By pathologizing states of mind, is that going to get us any closer to some sort of pre-crime forensics that would help us to actually prevent acts like these? Or does it turn our society into some kind of Maoist inform on your neighbor sort of place?
I think certainly we can identify signs of mental illness early, and we can understand from a research point of view the connections between mental illness and various forms of violence and crime. Once we've established that, we can certainly look for, you know, moving forward proactively, the telltale signs of mental illness, and then perhaps be a little more proactive in our interventions without necessarily, you know, using the labels and the stigma that often come associated with them.
But barring a specific diagnosis, all we're really talking about here is criminalizing states of mind, which is Maoist.
That's right. And from a forensic point of view, you're really coming in after the fact, after the person has entered the criminal justice system, has been arrested or convicted of a crime. And so we certainly know, you know, retrospectively, the relationships between states of mind and criminal behavior. Moving forward, though, you're absolutely right. We do not want to stigmatize. We don't want to necessarily, you know, be like the Minority Report movie, remember, where we're proactively incapacitating, incarcerating people so that they don't commit future crimes. It's a very tricky and touchy subject. I think on one hand, we can't pretend it doesn't exist, and on the other hand, we can't go, you know, over the top.
Yet for young men and women in colleges, there are all kinds of initiatives to try to prevent teen suicide, where for the same kinds of reasons, the same kinds of tensions and anger, the violence is brought against themselves. So we view that as something worthy. Is it possible that in the United States, where we have no availability of mental health, we don't equate that with health care, we stigmatize mental illness and seeking help for mental illness, we celebrate the individual, and we have extreme availability of guns, that this is just a society where anger rules and guns are simply a tool for acting out that anger?
Well, we certainly have a culture of violence. I think that can't be denied. You know, now most young males do not grow up to do these sort of Orlando or Santa Barbara shootings, but the ones that do, you know, there's other factors certainly in play.
Can we pay attention to anger? Can we just pay attention to that, the various reasons why people might be upset and in pain in some way, and take a more, you know, for lack of a better term, Christian view of the whole thing? You know, I am my brother's keeper. I mean, in the old United States, extended families taught that you take care of people who seem to be lonely. Now we celebrate the individual, let them get angry on their own, and then worry about whether they were mentally ill long after they've killed 50 people.
That's right. I agree with everything you just said, and I would piggyback on that point by saying we also have this, through social media, I believe, this kind of disconnect from each other as human beings. I think that's we're creating these rifts between us interpersonally that actually then isolate an individual and allow them to sort of, you know, seethe and that anger to kind of percolate. And to the other point, in terms of anger, I think we need to understand also anger is an emotion. An emotion is normal and human, and there are certainly appropriate ways to express anger and feel anger, and then there are inappropriate ways. And teaching people more of the former, right, that anger is okay, but this is how we express it and this is how we deal with it. I think that can be learned at an early age and certainly, you know, throughout the lifetime be practiced.
People who are involved in criminal justice and psychology say that interventions work in suicide prevention, that if an individual is approached and there is a dialogue and a channel is set up, that it's remarkably effective in preventing problems. In this particular case, no intervention. Omar Mateen was left to go on his own. It's sad to think that even the simplest initiative would have prevented this, if possible.
In terms of suicide, I think if somebody really wants to take their own life, they will. And I would actually say that that extends into this conversation, where if someone really wants to commit an act like this, they will, regardless of however many interventions we put in place. However, putting the interventions in place, I think, dramatically reduces the likelihood of these things actually being carried out.
All right. So Robert Shugg is an assistant professor of criminal justice and forensic psychology at California State University, Long Beach. He's author of the book Mental Illness and Crime. Thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.